Chapter 22. We rode up to Smithfield through a countryside coming to life again after the winter. The cattle out in the meadows again after months indoors. In the fields men were ploughing while women walked behind pairs of shaggy-hoofed horses casting grain from bags at their waists. I wondered what Lockley would be like. An ex-monk living at, perhaps running, a tavern was unusual, but with thousands thrown out of their monasteries, there were many stories stranger than that. We reached the great square of Smithfield. It wasn't a market day, and the big cattle pens were dismantled, stacked against the walls at the north end. To one side stood the great church of St. Bartholomew's, where, 3 years before, Barrack had saved my life in the course of our first assignment together. Behind the high walls I saw all the monastic buildings had come down now. Nearby stood the great empty hospital, reminding me again of my promise to Roger. Only a few hours now to his funeral. Barrack turned to me, nodding at the church.
"Remember?"
he asked.
"Aye,"
I sighed. "That was as dangerous a time as this." He shook his head.
"No. Then we were dealing with politicians. When they do villainy, they have reasons. They don't kill in a mad frenzy."
"As often as not, it's only for their own power and wealth."
"At least that's something comprehensible."
We rode on up Charterhouse Lane and under the stone arch leading into Charterhouse Square. This was a wide grassy area dotted with trees that covered the burial pits from the Great Plague of 200 years ago. An old chapel stood at its centre. A ragged little group of beggars sat huddled outside. To the north, beyond a low red brick wall, lay the buildings of the Charterhouse whose monks had defied the king over the break from Rome. Most had been brutally executed as a result. Cromwell had masterminded that, along with so much else. These days the buildings were used for storage, apart from those which I had heard had been made into lodgings for the king's Italian musicians, whom he had recently brought over at great expense. As with all the monastic houses, the monks had rented out land in their precinct. On this side of the square the dwellings were small and poor-looking, one- and two-story wooden affairs, but opposite was a row of fine stone and brick houses. I'd heard that the best one belonged to Lord Latimer, and now therefore to his widow, Catherine Parr. I studied a large red brick mansion with tall chimneys, the only house standing in its own drive. As I watched, a horseman in red livery galloped down the road, fronting the houses, and turned in at the drive, raising clouds of dust. More pressure from the king? Barrack brought me back to earth, pointing to a sign dangling over a narrow, ramshackle old building nearby.
"There's our place. The Green Man."
The sign showed a man clothed in vines, painted bright green. As we dismounted outside the tavern, the beggars came over to us. Maybe the chapel had been abandoned when the Charterhouse was dissolved and they had taken refuge there. Thin, dirty hands clutched at us as we tied the horses to the rail outside the tavern.
"Piss off," Barrack said, waving a couple of the hands away as he tied up.
After what had happened in the Westminster crowd, we both looked warily at the pinched faces, the ragged, stinking clothes. There were several children.
"Here,"
I called to a starveling lad of about 10 whose head was half bald and red raw, his hair eaten away by some disease. "Mind the horses and I'll give you a groat when I come out."
"I'll do it better."
Other hands plucked at my sleeve.
"He's fucking useless,"
another boy called out.
"Airless Harry."
"No," I said, shaking them off.
"Him."
We knocked on the tavern door and waited, ignoring fresh entreaties from the beggars. Footsteps sounded, and a woman opened it. She wore a stained apron over a creased dress and a white coif, from which tendrils of black hair escaped. She was powerfully built, short and square, but her face showed the remnants of past beauty. Her grey eyes were sharp and intelligent.
"We're not open till 5,
she said. "We don't want a drink," I answered. "We're looking for Francis Lockley." She gave us a sharp, suspicious look.
"What do you want with him?"
"Some private business," I smiled. "He's not in any trouble." She hesitated, then said,
"I suppose you'd better come in."
She looked at our boots, messy with the mud of the southern precinct.
"Wipe your feet. I don't want that mess all over the floor. I've just cleaned it."
We found ourselves in a medium-sized tavern with whitewashed walls and tables and chairs scattered round a rush-strewn floor. The woman put her hands on her hips and faced us.
"Did you give money to those beggars?"
she asked.
"They'll be hanging round half the day. They usually piss off to Smithfield about this time. I don't begrudge the poor caitiffs the shelter of the old chapel, but I don't want them pestering my customers."
I'd had enough of her scolding. "Do you work here?" I asked pointedly.
"I own the place. Ethel Bunce, widow and licensee of this parish, at your service,"
she added sardonically.
"Oh."
"Francis!"
she called loudly. A serving hatch in the wall opened, and a short, fat man with a bald head and a round, piggy face peered out. He too wore an apron, and behind him I saw a large bucket where wooden mugs floated in scummy water.
"Yes, chick?"
He caught sight of us, and immediately his eyes narrowed, and he looked worried.
"These gents want a word. What have you been up to?"
She laughed as she said this, but her look at us was as uneasy as the fat man's. Lockley emerged through a side door. He was a little barrel of a man, a powerful physique run to seed, but still strong-looking. I wondered if that was why Mistress Bunce had taken him in. A widow might inherit a tavern license, but would need a man to deal with difficult customers. Yet there was something loving in the look she gave Lockley as he sat on a stool beside her. I made a guess at why they seemed worried. They were living in sin. "We're not interested in the domestic arrangements between you," I said gently. "We've come from the King's Assistant Coroner. We seek the whereabouts of the former Brother Goddard of Westminster Abbey." The reactions of the pair to the news were quite different. Mistress Bunce looked relieved that no one was after them over their sleeping arrangements. Lockley, though, narrowed his eyes again and pressed his lips together. I saw from the rise and fall of his chest that he was breathing hard.
"That old shit Goddard?"
he asked.
"You didn't like him?"
"Treated me like dirt. Because my father was a pot man, as I am now,"
he added, glancing up at the widow with a look that was hard to read. She laid a strong hand over his.
"You're more to me than that, sweet."
I wondered whether to ask her to leave, but guessed that anything Lockley told us she would get out of him later.
"You worked under Goddard in the lay infirmary, I believe," I asked him, "helping him with sick people who came from Westminster town seeking help."
Mistress Bunce's eyes narrowed.
"You seem to know a lot about Francis."
"We are questioning the former monks who worked with Goddard. We've spoken with young Master Cantrell and with the Dean."
He looked suddenly worried.
"What did they have to say?"
he asked.
"That's confidential," I said.
Lockley laughed nervously.
"Young Charlie, eh? He had a bad time with Goddard."
"Have you any idea where Dr. Goddard may be now?" Lockley shook his head.
"Haven't seen him since the day we all left the Abbey, nor wanted to."
"You can't remember where he went?"
"Didn't even say goodbye. Just told me to clear out the last patients and hand the key to the treasurer as I was bid."
He hesitated.
"May I ask why you're seeking him?"
"We're investigating a death."
"Whose?"
he asked. His whole body seemed to tense again.
"I may not say."
But tell me, do you know anything about Dr. Goddard using a drug called Dwale? One of Lockley's hands was resting on the table, and he clenched it.
I knew Dr. Goddard used something to make his patients sleep if he had to operate on them in the monk's infirmary. But he wouldn't have wasted anything like that on the patients in the lay infirmary.
He shrugged.
He wasn't much interested in what went on there. He'd come in and look at people, give them a bit of advice or some herbs, set the odd broken bone. But mostly, he left their care to me.
He looked me in the eye as he told the story. He had himself under control now. I nodded slowly. Tell me more about what you thought of Dr. Goddard.
He had a high opinion of himself. Though I dare say doctors are all alike in that. He could be very sharp and rude.
He leaned forward, smiling confidentially.
He had a huge, great mole on one side of his nose. Biggest I've ever seen. If anyone looked at it, he'd go red and try to cover it with his hand. It was a way to get a rise out of him if you dared, but he'd always be in a foul mood afterwards.
He looked at Barak and grinned anxiously. I knew he was keeping something back, but I had no evidence, nothing to confront him with.
What was your background? Barak asked.
I was an apprentice to a barber surgeon before I went to Westminster. 10 years I was there. Then I worked with a barber surgeon again afterwards.
I see, I said. Young Cantrell didn't like Goddard either. I looked at him, remembering his worried look when I said we'd spoken to Cantrell and Dean Benson. But he'd regained some confidence now.
Aye, Goddard gave that boy a hard time. He had a nasty sharp tongue. But Charlie Cantrell was always a wet fart.
I saw the infirmary yesterday. Empty now, of course. It looked a gloomy place.
It was. Conditions got steadily worse all the time I was there. Abbot Benson wanted the abbey to go to seed to be closed.
Cromwell paid him well.
The old papist church was rotten,
he said with sudden fierceness. You're not one of those who still cleave to the old faith, then?
No.
Lockley frowned.
But the barber surgeon I worked for when I left was one of those hot gospelers. They're even worse, puffed up because they think they have the keys to hell and death. So, you came here to me,
Mistress Bunt said, squeezing his hand.
To find rest.
Lockley didn't respond to her gesture. Instead, he gave me an angry look.
Maybe neither the radicals nor the papists have it right. Maybe the heathen Turks do.
He laughed bitterly. I sensed something desperate, almost wild about him then. He wasn't a man at ease in his mind. Mistress Bunce laid her hand on his again.
Now, chick,
she said warningly, casting us a nervous glance.
He says things without thinking. You don't mean it, do you?
A sudden rumbling came from under the tavern, and I felt the stone flags tremble. I looked up, startled. From somewhere far below came the sound of rushing water.
What's that? Barak asked.
Lockley smiled faintly.
It makes new customers jump. They think the devil's coming up from hell to get them. We're connected to the old sewer that was built to drain the charter house. It runs under the cellar. The monks always did themselves well with their plumbing. Most of the buildings round the precinct are connected to their old sewer system. Water flushes down from springs up at Islington Fields. Yes?
The widow took the chance to move the conversation away from religion.
We have our own little room of easement that drains down there, and all the tavern's waste goes through a cellar hatch into the sewer. The only thing is, the watchman of the charter house has to be reminded to open the lock gates under the old monastery, or the water builds up, then rushes through like just now. He's a drunk. But there's no one else lives there now, except those Italian musicians of the King's. And they're just stupid foreigners.
Lockley gave me another challenging look.
Ethel was here when the Charterhouse defied Cromwell, refused to accept the royal supremacy. Prior Houghton was taken out, hanged, drawn and quartered at Tyburn, his arm nailed to the door of the gate. You remember that, Ethel, don't you?
It was a long time ago,
Mistress Bunce said uneasily.
Religious folks!
His face twisted with contempt, and something more than that, pain. In his own way, like Cantrell, he was one of those who had suffered from the changes. He got up.
Well, sir, we must get back to work. I'm sorry I couldn't help you more.
I hesitated, then rose too. Thank you, sir. If you think of anything else, please contact me. Master Shardlake at Lincoln's Inn.
I will.
He looked relieved the interview was over. We may well call again, I added lightly. His face fell. He was hiding something, I was sure.
I'll see you out.
Mistress Bunce rose and accompanied us to the door. In the doorway, she looked round to make sure Lockley couldn't hear, then lowered her voice.
I'm sorry for his words about religion, sir, she said quietly. Francis has had a hard time. He was used to life at the Abbey. He found life outside hard, especially with that gospel-leaning barber surgeon pestering him to join their faith. He started drinking, would come here and get drunk every night. That was when I took him in. I know drunks. I knew that love and care and something to do could help Francis.
She looked at me, her bossy manner gone, a tired and vulnerable woman.
He doesn't drink now, but he says bitter things.
Don't worry, good wife, I said gently. I have no interest in good man Lockley's beliefs.
He's bitter he's ended up a pot man, like his father was.
She looked at me, utterly weary.
Strange how the world turns, isn't it, sir?
We rode away from the tavern deep in thought. Barrack broke the silence.
He was hiding something, wasn't he?
I think he was. Something about Goddard.
I might have forced it out of him.
No, that's Harsnett's job. I'll tell him tonight.
I don't think the woman knows anything.
No, poor creature. I don't think she gets much thanks for her care of him.
Maybe he'll order him in for some stiff questioning.
Yes. I didn't like the idea of the bitter, disappointed little man being treated roughly, but if he was hiding something, we had to find out what it was. We returned to my house. I was tired. My arm sore whenever I moved it. I could have done with an evening at home resting, but I was due at the chapel for the funeral. I wondered what Samuel would be like. I hadn't seen him since he was a toddler. Tamsin was lying on a pile of cushions in the parlour when we came in. Her eyes were less puffy, but her features were still a mass of brightly coloured bruises, and her mouth was swollen. She looked utterly exhausted.
"How are you, chick?"
Barrack asked, with what sounded to me like forced cheerfulness.
"Sore. My mouth hurts."
Her voice was a mumble, and when she opened her mouth, I saw her cheeks were padded with blood-stained cotton. I shuddered, and my tongue went to the gap in my own mouth, where 2 years before I had had a tooth snapped off by a torturer in the tower.
"By Mary, it hurts,"
she said. Barrack went over and put an arm around her.
"Could have been worse," he said. "The tooth was at the side. You still have your pretty smile."
"Oh, that's all right then," she said sarcastically.
"I didn't mean..." Tamsin looked at me.
"Do you know what the wretch said? The tooth drawer. When he told me his fee would be 5 shillings, I told him it was too much. He said he'd waive the fee and give me 10 shillings if I'd let him take out all my teeth. Said I had a good set, and they make a good false set for rich folk.
She looked at me.
He brought out these wooden blocks shaped like people's jaws. Wanted to measure them against the size of my mouth. He said my mouth was a good standard size. I told him to forget it and get on with his work, though he was artless to show me such things when I was in pain. I was surprised that Dr. Morton recommended him.
He's lucky I wasn't there, Barrack said. The arsehole.
Though I suppose he did the job quickly enough and with less pain than I expected.
Tamsin shuddered.
Ugh, he was a vile man. His apron stained with blood, a necklace of teeth hanging over his shop sign.
You should go to bed, Tamsin, I said. Rest.
Are you going to Master Elliard's funeral, sir?
She asked.
Yes. I must change. I am going to Dorothy's.
I am accompanying her household.
When I come back, Barrack, we'll have a quick supper, then go to meet Harsnett. I was thinking, he said, this church, St. Agatha's, Irish Lane. Isn't it the one where the steeple fell down a couple of years ago?
Yes, it's one of the reformers' churches. There's no need for you to come, I added. I glanced meaningfully at Tamsin.
Barrack shrugged. Arsenet said both of us in his letter. He might have things for me to do.
I opened my mouth to protest, then closed it again. If I remonstrated with him in front of Tamsin, that would only infuriate him.
I'll be all right,
she said pointedly.
That's good, Barrack said. You rest.
I met Tamsin's eye.
She looked furious.
For the first time since Roger's death, Dorothy was dressed in her best. Beside her stood a slim, dark lad of 18, handsome in his black doublet, whose resemblance to his father was so close it almost took my breath away. It was as though Roger had returned.
Samuel, Dorothy said, you won't remember Master Shardlake. You were but a child when we moved to Bristol.
The boy bowed to me.
I remember you, sir. You brought me a spinning top for my birthday. It was very brightly coloured. I thought it a marvel.
His voice was like Roger's, clear and a little sharp, though Samuel spoke with the flat vowels of the West Country.
Yes, I said with a laugh. I remember now. You were 5. You have a good memory.
I do for kindness, yes. I must thank you for all you've done for my mother.
He laid a hand on Dorothy's.
She's been very brave.
Is Samuel not the very image of Roger?
There were tears in Dorothy's eyes.
He is.
It comforts me. Roger lives on in my son. But Matthew, you hold your arm strangely. Have you done something to it?
How observant she was.
A careless accident. It's not serious. Will you stay in London long, Samuel?
He shook his head.
I must go back to Bristol next week. There's a cloth fair I must attend. I'm hoping that when matters are settled, my mother may come and join me there.
Oh.
I'd not thought she might go so soon. The news disconcerted me.
Time enough to think of that later, Dorothy said. There are things to arrange, and I can't leave everything to Matthew. Though he looks after me, he has been my rod and staff.
She smiled at me warmly.
I do what I can, I said, embarrassed.
My son is engaged, Matthew, she said quietly. What do you think of that? To a Bristol merchant's daughter?
Samuel blushed.
Congratulations, I said.
Thank you, sir. We hope to marry next year.
There was a knock at the door. Margaret came in.
"The coffin is here,"
she said quietly. Dorothy shuddered, looked utterly bereft again.
"I will see them,"
she said.
"Let me,"
Samuel said.
"No, no. Let me go alone."
She squeezed his arm, then left the room, leaving Samuel and me alone. There was an awkward silence for a moment. The clock ticked. I looked at the wooden frieze, the botched repair in the corner catching my eye, then smiled at Samuel.
"Is there any more news, sir, of the investigation?"
he asked hesitantly. I realized it must be hard for him, suddenly thrust into a man's role by this tragedy.
"It eats away at Mother," he continued, "not knowing why my father was killed in that awful way. If he'd been attacked in a robbery, it would have been bad enough, but that terrible display."
He looked at me anxiously.
"And you said she may be in danger."
I thought, she has kept her word to me about not telling anyone about the other killings. She hasn't even told her son.
"It's only a precautionary measure," I said.
"We're making progress, Samuel. I can't say much now, but if it helps, I may tell you that we believe your father wasn't killed from malice against him. I think he attracted the attention of, let us say, of a madman. I think you can tell your mother that much."
"But why is it so secret?"
the boy burst out.
"It worries Mother, though she won't say so."
I hesitated, then spoke cautiously. "There are politics involved. There was another murder, like your father's. The victim was a man of some importance. Though that wasn't why he was killed, it was just this madman chose him too."
"A lunatic,"
Samuel frowned.
"Yes, anyone who killed a man as good as my father would have to be mad."
"Roger was a good man and a good friend. But don't press me now, Samuel. I've told you more than I should have already." He nodded slowly.
"Poor Mother. How they loved each other."
He laughed nervously.
"I used to feel left out sometimes. That was why I stayed in Bristol, to make my own life. Yet I love Father. He did so much for me."
Suddenly Samuel was a boy again, blushing and with tears in his eyes.
"Take care of Mother, sir. She says you and Margaret are only true friends."
"I will," I said. "I will."
"I wish she would come back to Bristol with me, but she's stubborn."
Dorothy reappeared in the doorway, pale, holding herself tightly.
"The other mourners are gathering outside. His friends, the servants. We must go."
I took a deep breath and followed Samuel from the room.